You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 22nd of March 2023 on Monocle 24.
President Emmanuel Macron of France defends his determination to make his fellow citizens work longer. Boris Johnson swears on Bible. Millions of TV viewers swear at him. And the possibility that the sensitivity to mockery of President Xi Jinping of China has deprived Hong Kong cinema goers of a dreadful evening's entertainment. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Rebecca Tinsley and Jonathan Fenby will discuss all the day's big stories, and we'll anticipate the comeback of Art Basel Hong Kong. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by Rebecca Tinsley, journalist and founder of Network for Africa, and by Jonathan Fenby, author and a consultant on China. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
Rebecca, first of all, you are deigning to interact with the lower orders this evening, having recently been hosting royalty.
I was amazed last week to be contacted by the palace, who offered us the king to come to meet 40 Sudanese refugees. I founded a little charity called Waging Peace back in 2004 when I returned from Darfur, where there was a genocide, and we have been supporting Sudanese refugees ever since. So imagine my surprise when the palace said, "The prince,
it's still taking some getting used to.
It is actually at church every week we sing God Save the Queen. Anyway, imagine my surprise. So the significant thing about this visit was that it was 2 days after the government tried to push through the illegal migration bill in the Commons. Yeah. And the Foreign Office arrived at our little event, we having assembled our 40 Sudanese representatives, and the Foreign Office and said, "You mustn't be political." And then somebody from the palace came in and said, "Be as political as you like, because there's a reason the king is here today." Mm. You know, he wants to meet these people. And to his credit, he said hello and listened to every single one of our 40 Sudanese. And at the end, he said, "I'm so glad you are all safe. I want all of you to be safe."
I mean, did you get a sense, seeing it up close, of the impact, whether you like the fact that we have a monarchy or not, or agree with it or not, there is a gravitas attached to the occupant of the throne. What was your sense of what it meant to the people he spoke to?
Coming from a vile dictatorship where politicians tend to murder and disappear people,
which we will be discussing further later.
We will, but they have a cynical approach to politicians. Mm. But a king, now that's something special. And I have to say that, you know, I have never been interested in the royal family. I am the only person on record in the UK of my age not to have watched the Charles Diana wedding. I had better things to do that day.
I was far away in another part of the world, so I missed it too.
But I have to say, I am now smitten. Having seen the man in action, I was actually really moved by his dedication. And it meant so much to those people that he repeated, you know, "I am the king of all the people in this country, whatever your background or faith." Mm. That really meant something to them.
See, I struggle to compete with that. I think the only royal personage I've met up close and personally. We did have the King of Lesotho on the foreign desk once, but that was by Zoom. I was once received by His Royal Highness the Fon of Binka, a regional monarch in Cameroon, who gave me a chicken.
Well, you could fool me.
Yeah. Jonathan, you have met both the current incumbent and the predecessor, haven't you?
I met the current incumbent at dinner parties a while ago when I was editing a national newspaper here, and it was, I think, part of the palace trying to get butter up editors. I met his mother, the late Queen, on a couple of occasions. On one occasion, at a dinner at Buckingham Palace, and I hope I'm allowed to say this now, I can swear that as we went in and shook hands, I heard the Duke of Edinburgh hissing at me, "Bow, man, bow," which I didn't do. And then when I was awarded the CBE, the Queen pinned it on me, or somebody pinned it on me, gave it to me, and then she said, "Ah, you were in Hong Kong during the handover. That must have been interesting." And I drew in my breath and said, "As a matter of fact, it was." And before I could go any further, I was ushered onto one side.
I wonder how many times she's heard the wind-up, "as a matter of fact," and then...
Exactly. Yeah. I think the courtiers are well prepared and get rid of people who might talk too much, or talk at all.
But neither of you got a chicken, so I think I'm out in front here.
Yes.
But we will start properly in France, where President Emmanuel Macron has been defending his decision to force through the key plank of his pension reform, a hike in France's pension age from 62 to 64. The fact that this will still rank among the lowest in the world does not seem to have impressed the hundreds of thousands of people who have taken repeatedly to the streets in demonstrations notably vast and rowdy, even when adjusted for the fact that they're happening in France, where minor gripes which would elicit mere ineffectual tutting elsewhere prompt a levering up of cobblestones. Further protests and strikes are planned for Thursday. Jonathan, France, one of many countries that you have reported from, written about extensively. Is Macron banking at this point that everyone, now that this has gone through, is going to get bored and go home, and is he right?
Yes, on the first count, and no on the second count. What we've had in France, despite the fact that the French presidency, it's more than a royal family, it's more than the king, it is the most powerful executive post in a democracy in Western Europe. But despite all its powers, repeated presidents, ever since 1968 and the protests and strikes then, have found it very difficult to push through basic policies against popular opposition. This is one of the paradoxes of France. But what has usually happened is that after the protests and or strikes, there have been elections, and the conservative majority, the silent majority, if you like, has returned a centre-right majority. Now, Macron may be counting on that, but in this case, I think it's a bit different, because there are obviously the selfish reasons that people want to retire early, want to keep their good pension pots, which they've got, particularly from state-owned enterprises. But it's somehow the pensions in France, a bit like the National Health Service in Britain, have become part of how people see the national fabric, the national structure. It's something, it's more than simply pensions. And Macron is seen, I think, quite widely, including a lot of people who normally would not protest this, as being somebody who wants to destroy the architecture of the state.
That said, Rebecca, his government has survived two no-confidence motions brought against it in Parliament. Does that not shore his position up, or is he just going to have to, well, as we were suggesting, grit his teeth and hope he outlasts the dissenters?
Well, first of all, he is an amazingly lucky guy, isn't he? First of all, the first time he stood, he had François Fillon, who imploded and allowed him to get through to the second round against the very toxic Marine Le Pen, who then, for the second election, more recently, again, Marine Le Pen. And, you know, it was like, a choice of, do you want gonorrhea? No, you don't. You want... So he's a very lucky guy. Also, I think we tend to look at French politics from our Anglo sphere, but they are more used to the idea of cohabitation. Mitterrand had to cohabit, you know, with Chirac and Bayadur, and Chirac, when he was president, had to cohabit with Jospin. And I think that, you know, we shouldn't be thinking he's finished. He's not at all finished. But if I could say so, I actually think this protest should prompt the rest of Western Europe, indeed, to look at the whole business of pensions because of the demographic changes. Mm-hmm. You know, why are we basing pensions on such an arbitrary basis? Surely it would be better to look at when you started working and when you finished working.
And perhaps even what kind of work.
And what kind of work. Because let's be honest, if you know, if David Attenborough had been working in a call centre or down a mine or cleaning loos, he would not still be working at the age of 103 or whatever he is. But it is a question all democracy should be asking.
I mean, this is a thing we have come back to a few times while we've been discussing this along the journey. And you know, I come from a country, Australia, where the pension age is 67, which is already 3 years in advance of what Macron proposes to raise it to. But is there something there, Jonathan, that needs to be got seriously to grip with? The idea, and France being an example, you have a pension age of 62 and a life expectancy of 82. And the old age pension, when instituted, was never intended to subsidise a two-decade-long holiday.
Absolutely not. And as Macron keeps pointing out, there were something like 7 million people eligible for pensions when he himself started working, and now they're 19 million. And this is a problem for the state. State finances, for the whole way you organise society. And a lot of, I mean, I know people in France who were forced to retire at this relatively early age, who didn't want to at all and were quite happy to go on working and were quite capable of it.
Just a final thought on this one, Rebecca. You mentioned, and you're right to mention it, that this is something that advanced countries, advanced economies all over the world are probably going to have to make some fairly tough decisions about. Will watching Macron's experience discourage them from doing that, or will most other countries just calculate that, France gonna France, this is not really something we need to factor in?
Oh, I think this will scare the hell out of them. I think this is one of those subjects. It's like fixing Social Security in the States. It is the third rail. Can I just mention, though, I actually was present for one of these demos because I was in Nice a couple of weeks ago, and it was fascinating to watch. And my conclusion was the French just have an awful lot more fun at their demonstrations. It was really jolly. And, you know, you think of the British protests that one has seen or been on, and it's always a bunch of miserable people from Free Palestine with their tatty banner, even incidentally, if it's a demo against cruelty to badgers. Free Palestine's there, and a few Trotskyists, with the socialist worker.
Or middle class people from Stoke Newington waving insufferably whimsical placards.
Exactly.
No, you're right. The French do appear to enjoy it. The first time I ever got tear gassed was in Paris. It's basically like being welcomed to the city. Tremendously enjoyable day.
I was tear gassed many times as a correspondent in Paris. But kind of people went for it, and it's part of, if you like, the national theatre, ballet.
I did get the impression that demonstrators and police alike were enjoying the afternoon tremendously.
And my wife, who is French, always insists that that's why services work better in France, because people complain. And they might break your shop window.
Here in the rather more acquiescent, regrettably, United Kingdom, a clutch of Brexiter headbanger MPs are trying to thwart solutions to the problems Boris Johnson caused for Northern Ireland, and Boris Johnson himself is seeking to weasel his way out of a scandal occasioned by his own cavalier disregard of the rules everyone else has to live by. And we should probably reassure listeners at this point that they have not, in fact, fallen through some wormhole in the space-time continuum back to maybe 2019 or so. As the new Northern Ireland deal of current Prime Minister Rishi Sunak passed the Commons, previous Prime Minister but one Boris Johnson fronted the Privileges Committee over what has become known as Partygate. Johnson, appearing in his more serious haircut, set out his defence at the opening of the session.
At all times, I was entirely transparent with the House. I made it clear that I did not intend to comment on any of the factual matters until the investigation had been concluded. I kept the House regularly updated, and as soon as the investigations were complete, I provided a full correction of my honest but inadvertently misleading statements. I apologise. I apologise for inadvertently misleading this House. But to say that I did it recklessly or deliberately is completely untrue, as the evidence shows.
Boris Johnson there kicking off this afternoon's inquisition. Jonathan, first of all, we should clarify that in the Westminster tradition, intentionally misleading the House is no small change. That is supposed to be a resignation issue.
It's supposed to be a resignation issue, and it could provoke, obviously, a by-election in his constituency. This is very serious, but I think what one gets out of this whole episode and the interrogation this afternoon is really the feeling that Boris Johnson is yesterday's man. There. Now, he won't be able to swallow that. It was only a few months ago after Liz Truss's downfall that people were talking about, will Boris come back? But I think the answer after this afternoon, whatever the committee decides, is no.
It's a brave person at this point, Jonathan, who pronounces, surely this is the end for Boris Johnson.
Yes, that
has been a recurring...
You can play that to me.
A recurring motif of British public life for about 30 years, and here we still are.
Yeah. But what I think is interesting in this, I mean, from his defence, or what I saw of him himself, is that he is saying he did not mislead the House because he believed that Downing Street was operating within the guidelines, within the rules, and so on. Now, give him the benefit of the doubt. You may
Do
find
we have
it difficult to.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yes. I'm going to give him the benefit of that. Perhaps he actually believes that, in which case that says something about his judgment and his view, his analysis of what these regulations meant. Because quite clearly, from the photographs and all the evidence and the 126 fixed penalty notices which were issued by the police against Downing Street people, this was not the case. And he's telling us the opposite.
Rebecca, were you at all swayed by what Boris Johnson had to say today?
Not at all. And I think it all comes down to the word intent. And rather like the definition of genocide, and I realise I'm on Lineker ground here, but it is all about intent. As I listened to him, I recalled the words of Humpty Dumpty, who said, "When I use a word, it means exactly what I want it to mean. Nothing less and nothing more." And he's doing it again. And anyway, who would you try? He's also trying to put the blame on the civil servants. And frankly, who would you believe, Boris or the civil servants?
The civil servants and also political appointees, who it turned out as in the evidence that his quote expert advice, which one is it, didn't come from a senior civil servant or a health official, but came from his media spin doctor.
Jonathan, to follow up on your confident pronunciation of him as yesterday's man, do you think today will nevertheless have played quite well with the not inconsiderable Boris Johnson cult that still exists?
They will make a lot of noise, but I think the more noise they make really reflects the fact that their numbers are diminishing and diminishing, and that the Northern Ireland deal got through with only 29, I think it was 29 votes against.
29 against, only 22 Tory rebels.
Yeah, it's pretty small.
But remember that Lord Cruddas is putting a lot of money into stirring it up at a local level in Tory constituencies all over the country to deselect Tory MPs who cause trouble for Boris. So those MPs have to make a choice. They have to say, do I dare to go up against my constituency association now that they're being stirred up by Cruddas? Or do I guess that if Boris was leader once more, I might hold my seat? And we're once again in this Tory party death spiral, aren't we? It's like a suicide cult.
Well, to increase my danger zone, Andrew, I think that what happened today will increase the probability that Tory MPs will stand up and say, that's enough, Boris, thank you.
One final thought on this, Rebecca, and just following on from Jonathan's confident declaration, which certainly won't come back to haunt him, that Boris Johnson is finished. On the subject of that rebellion, is it overtly wishful thinking at this point to suspect that maybe the air has gone out of the European Research Group as well? This is a fairly meagre rebellion. It is very much the usual suspects. Might we have heard something like the last of them?
I really do hope so. And obviously Rishi Sunak will hope so as well, because he wants to continue with this seriousness thing. But what does it say about us as a country that anybody could seriously be thinking of having this bloke, Boris Johnson, this clown, this very unserious man, back in Downing Street. It boggles the mind.
Well, we can all enjoy playing this conversation back to ourselves 2 years hence when he triumphantly leads the Tories back to however many terms they would now be up to. But we will now look at Sudan, where it is getting on for 4 years since Sudan's military overthrew the interminably serving tyrant and war crimes indictee President Omar al-Bashir, and for 2 years since Sudan's military overthrew the rickety civilian government which succeeded him. As is often the case, when chaps clad in khaki and decorated in gold braid seize power, the rebel officers have generally made all the right and proper noises about a transition to democracy. As is very nearly often the case, Sudan's generals have gone about this at a somewhat stately pace. However, a date, specifically April 11th, does now appear to have been set for the establishment of a new civilian-led Sudanese government. Rebecca, tempting the fates appears to be the recurring theme of today's episode. Is this good?
It would be if it was going to happen, but I have to say, having cared deeply about this country for the last 20 years, since, as I said earlier, I visited Darfur at the height of the killing, and I then set up my little NGO waging peace, I am not optimistic. But first of all, I just wanted, in case your listeners are thinking, why does Sudan matter? If you care about immigration to the UK, you should care about what is going to happen in Sudan, because Sudan provides the fifth largest group of asylum seekers coming to this country. And if things continue to go badly in Sudan, which I fear that they will, then there are going to be lots more Sudanese heading here. I think it will go badly because there is no reason to believe that the military or the Muslim Brotherhood in Sudan are prepared to actually hand power to a civilian administration. The Muslim Brotherhood, everybody talks about the military, but they are entwined with the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood, in turn, control the deep state in Sudan. They basically control the economy. There is no way on earth that these guys are going to give up power unless the international community continues to pay great attention and to hold all those concerned to their promises once we get the transitional government. And I have to say that having looked at, followed this situation for the past 20 years, there is no evidence that the international community will actually continue its focus on Sudan.
There's a couple of things to come back to there, but first of all, Jonathan, do you share this scepticism? General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan did say today, or this week at least, that the army will not take part in politics from here on.
But the army itself is divided, is it not?
This is true.
I think. Yeah, so you've got the two military factions fighting against each other, and whatever may be said, what is the basis for a stable civilian government there?
I mean, Rebecca, I don't see it. How serious is that schism within the military?
Oh, it's massive. And in fact, I really don't want to do this, but I think you could predict that there will be a further coup and there might even be civil war. Yeah. The very people who carried out the genocide in Darfur, the Janjaweed, have since rebranded as the Rapid Support Force. And they are currently being rebranded as the Sudanese Armed Forces. And guess what? They don't want to take orders from the normal Sudanese army. So, and there is an incredible prima donna in charge of the Janjaweed who really does think that he should run Sudan. So, that is just a problem that's not going to go away. Mm. And, the people on the street who have been amazingly brave throughout all of this, they, in their gut, because we do talk to them all the time, in their gut, they know that they would be idiots to take the word of the military or the Muslim Brotherhood. And that is why they keep appealing to the international community to pay attention, to have a system of justice. That would help. Sending Bashir, Field Marshal Omar Bashir, who was the dictator for 30 years, sending him to the ICC, that would help as well. And actually being prepared to sanction the Sudanese military, if it goes back on its promises. That would help as well. But, you know, I'm not sure I believe any of those things will happen.
Jonathan, that thought of the rest of the world taking their eye off it or not wishing to get within a barge pole's length of it, that does seem all too plausible, doesn't it?
It does indeed. I'm afraid, you know, there are a lot of tragic situations which continue for far too long because, basically, the great powers of this world either want to use them for their own advantage in one way or other, or keep their hands clean of them. And that I fear is going to be the case with Sudan too.
We will do a seamless gear change of the type for which this program is famous into something altogether more trivial and look at Hong Kong, where there are mixed tidings for cinema goers. The new Winnie the Pooh oriented horror film Blood and Honey has been yanked from the schedules of Hong Kong and Macau. This is arguably good news in as much as it spares the people of Hong Kong and Macau from any risk of sitting through what looks, to judge by the trailers and the reviews, an absolutely atrocious waste of everybody's time, but indisputably bad news vis-a-vis the further deterioration of the local climate where freedom of speech is concerned. There is a rumour at large that the withdrawing of Blood and Honey is connected to the vexation of Chinese President Xi Jinping, with persistent memes likening him, in fact, to the rotund Ursine cartoon. Jonathan, do you believe that? Do you think, like, yes, President Xi Jinping stays up at night seething about the Winnie the Pooh gags?
No, he doesn't. I mean, I must say, first of all, the film sounds absolutely horrific. Horrific is the phrase, perhaps something one would keep well clear of. I don't think Xi Jinping probably knows who Winnie the Pooh is, but people around him have certainly seen online postings depicting him as Winnie the Pooh. This began when he met Obama in the United States around 2013-2014, and there were photographs of the somewhat rotund Xi Jinping walking with the much more lithe and slender Obama, and people online put Winnie the Pooh's head on Xi Jinping and one of the other characters.
Tigger.
Tigger. And this then became, this was taken down, of course, because this was lèse majesté towards the Chinese ruler. But it then became almost a symbol online of opposition to Xi Jinping and mocking him. And I'm sure that the obedient knights in the Chinese leadership compound will be watching out for this and would hold it up as yet another sign of how untrustworthy the Hong Kong people are.
Rebecca, the official line from the pertinent Hong Kong authorities is that they approved the film, there's no problem with the film, the decision is entirely a commercial or technical one, nothing to do with them at all. Do we believe that?
No, we don't, but I think on aesthetic grounds, I mean, it should be.
Yes, there are.
It's an art crime, and I think I'm going to have nightmares about it because I adore Pooh. And how sad for President Xi that he didn't have Pooh in his childhood. Things might be very different.
Well, he was up in a cave in Shaanxi province, you know, during the Cultural Revolution. I don't think there were many Winnie the Pooh books around there.
Possibly not. But I did want to talk a bit more about... It is, I think, I can't think of an exception. Jonathan, you may have encountered an exception, but it's a commonplace among tyrants and dictators, a complete humorlessness and a hypersensitivity, extraordinary thin-skinnedness. I mean, my own favourite illustration of that was the one time I visited Iraq when Saddam Hussein was still in charge, and the photographer I was with had this idea that we would get our driver that we'd hired to take us around Baghdad, and he would take lots of photos of the various preposterous representations of Saddam Hussein, the statues and posters and mosaics, and that would be a great montage for our story, which was a great idea. And we set off to do it, and there was quite a way into it. The driver pulled into a quiet street and he just said, "Guys, I'm happy for the work and I'm happy to do this. You have to stop laughing." Because he said, "We are being followed." He said, "Not by people you can see or I can see, but we're being followed and we're being watched. And if they see me with people laughing at the president, it'll be trouble."
Indeed.
So we had to spend the entire day sort of these absolutely hatchet-faced expressions, which obviously became harder and harder to maintain as the day went on.
And as you were finding more and more fun.
Well, exactly.
No, there's no doubt that autocrats, dictators, hate humour. It's something they cannot live with.
Not just autocrats.
Yes, a lot of other politicians
too. Anyone who believes in the great man theory of politics, and Boris Johnson being a perfect example, Trump another example, they are just surprisingly delicate little creatures underneath it all, underneath all that bluster, aren't they?
I do always, it's something I always look for when I, on such occasions as I have visited the offices of politicians. I genuinely think it's a good sign if they've got the framed originals of cartoons making fun of them hanging up around their desk.
Yeah.
Have you encountered any particularly shocking examples of this that you can recall, Rebecca?
Oh, yeah. Years ago, when I was involved, for reasons, it's all very sad, really, but I was involved in the Liberal Party in this country, and I was good chums with David Steele, who may be remembered by a few people here.
Yep.
A program called Spitting Image did a puppet of David Owen, who was in a cohabitation with David Steele, as it were.
Politically.
And David Steele was this pathetic little creature in his top pocket.
Yeah.
That actually destroyed David Steele.
Really?
Absolutely. He could never be taken seriously after that, and it really punctured his ego.
It got to him personally.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was very sad to see.
It's funny you say that, because the illustration of what I was talking about that I always think of was a later Liberal leader, Paddy Ashdown, whose office I visited in Sarajevo when he was High Representative, basically King of Bosnia, entirely decorated, and with the originals, which he had written off for and paid for, of decades of cartoons making fun of him.
But he was a different kind of guy. I also had the honour of knowing Paddy quite well, and there was a man, you know, who could kill someone with his bare hands while speaking Mandarin. And, nothing was going to touch this guy.
Jonathan, have any epically pompous, humourless autocrats you've encountered personally?
Oh, a lot of the Chinese leadership, to go back to them, Xi Jinping and so on, one does not make jokes with them. And when I was editing the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong, they would take offence usually at cartoons or any photograph showing them in a less than flattering light. And that the paper would get seized in Beijing and Shanghai, not because of the acres of copy analysing Chinese politics, but because of the image.
Did they ever come back to you personally complaining about particular cartoons or caricatures?
No, they told me to get a new set of opinion posters. So the public would, if we get it to the right public. But
Jonathan Fenby and Rebecca Tinsley, thank you both for joining us. Finally today, Art Basel Hong Kong, one of Asia's biggest arts fairs, kicks off this Thursday, March 23rd. It's its first iteration since Hong Kong rather scrapped the last of its many pandemic restrictions in March, and listeners can obviously go to this if they can't go and see a Winnie the Pooh horror film. Monocle's Naomi Shu Elegant spoke to the fair's director, Angel Xiangla, to hear more.
It's the year coming out of the pandemic. So if I tell you it's easy peasy, I'm definitely lying. It's been challenging, not just for us, for many people in Asia, since, you know, we kind of head out of the pandemic around 6 to 8 months later than the rest of the world. With lots of changes, lots of uncertainties to start with, but now we ended up with 177 galleries, with the level of enthusiasm, you know, from all our audience around the world. We are so happy to see the level of support from all aspects. And this year, we are not only bringing back, you know, the elements that's been at our shows for a number of years, but also like new elements, for example, public art. We're bringing art outside of the convention center, to Pacific Place, which is one of our large-scale installations for the encounter sectors, will be staged at Pacific Place, which is a sponsored project by Swire Properties, one of our partners, and as well as collaborations with M+, this moving image by Swiss artist Pippi Lotti-Ristz will be playing, you know, repetitively from this coming Saturday, actually, until the end of the show. And it will be visible, you know, throughout the shows in Hong Kong. And the facade is bright and, you know, is really high definition. You can see it even standing from the peak.
Are there any exhibitions or artists that you're really looking forward to in particular?
Yes, there are a lot on the show floor, obviously. The ones I would like to highlight, there are a few. For example, in our inside sector, our local artist Stanley Wong is staging his signature installations by using what we call Hong Bat Lan, the red, white, blue bags. And at the same time, he probably doesn't even know this. In another sector, Discovery Sector, there will be a Nigerian artist represented by Monique Amolosh, will be bringing Lyle Bright. The artist will also be using very similar materials, however, it's named differently. The materials is named Ghana Must Go Bag, but fundamentally, these materials came from the same source, which is Hong Kong. So obviously the two artists had completely different backgrounds and interpret the materials totally differently according to the different history and upbringing. It's just such a beautiful coincidence that these two artists staging completely different installations and sculptures inside two different booths on two different floors using the same materials but interpreting very different stories. That really just tells, you know, Hong Kong is a melting pot of culture and our show is a true international platform to bring together different ideas, different identities, as well as different cultures.
What proportion of the artists is our local Hong Kong artists versus international, and what kind of countries are the international artists coming from?
There are in total 32 countries and territories participating in the show this year. We not only have a strong representative from Asia, actually 2/3 of the galleries participating in the show have gallery space in Asia. That's also the results, from the past years when we built like a deeper relationship with the regions, you know, scouting like new galleries and establish new relationships. And until today, we really is the international show spotlighting Asia's best modern and contemporary art. And other than Asia's, you know, we have a strong representative from Europe as well as America. And this year, like I just mentioned, with the Nigeria artists, we also have a strong representation from Africa, including a new African gallery, Retro Africa, coming to our show for the first time.
So you've obviously spent months preparing for this. Where can we expect you on the actual days itself? Will you be running around the gallery floors, or what will you be doing?
I will definitely be on the show floor, so you probably will catch me, a glimpse of me here and there. During the shows, it's my job to really make sure that the galleries are, you know, are doing business smoothly. Our, you know, VIPs are being greeted. We receive visitors from all over the world, and it's really the first time we can receive them, you know, from outside of Hong Kong. So yes, I definitely make sure that I will be on site, but also I will be at our conversations sector, because it's also the first year we're bringing back physical conversation, physical panels onto the show floor, as well as our film sector. So we will have a film receptions followed by the screenings at 4:30 p.m. on the second day of the show, 22nd of March. And from the second day of the shows, there will also be panels throughout the 4 days, having more than 82 speakers coming to the show.
That was Angèle Siangler speaking to Naomi Zhu Elegant about Art Basel Hong Kong, which starts tomorrow. And that is all for this edition of The Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Rebecca Tinsley and Jonathan Fenby. Today's show was produced by Lillian Fawcett and researched by Andre Nikolai Pamantuan. Our sound engineer was Adam Heaton. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.